Welcome to Research Conversations, a podcast powered by the Digital Legal Lab.
Hi there, this is a podcast from me, Bart van der Sloot, about my new book that's just been published, Regulating the Synthetic Society, Generative AI Legal Questions and Societal Challenges. So the book is about AI, and we thought it might be a nice idea to ask ChatGPT to interview me, or at least to come up with the interview questions. So I posted this question to ChatGPT. I'm interviewing the author of this book. Can you read the book and then take your time to reflect on it? And the reason why I asked to reflect on it and take time is, weirdly enough, also a prompt like take a deep breath or something, that actually helps AI models sometimes to be more comprehensive, more accurate, etc. Probably because it's kind of copying human behavior, or that it's kind of using it as a prompt that it's really important to get it right. No one really knows. But anyway, that's the reason. So I put a link in the question and then asked, like, can you come up with 10 questions for the author? And it was actually interesting because it replied, well, I'm not allowed to access external links, but I could give you like 10 general questions you could ask the author. And these are questions you could ask any author, basically. And it's interesting because I'm not going to use these to guide this podcast, but still, you could actually see an interview go like that. They're pretty generic and general, but still you see interviews being conducted like this. I will give you some examples, like, what inspired you to write this book? And can you share a bit about your research and writing process? How did you select your themes? What challenges did you face when writing this book, and how did you overcome them? What is your favorite part of the book and why? What do you hope readers will take away from this book, both intellectually and emotionally? What future projects are you working on? Did you have feedback yet? And what was it? Stuff like that. So still pretty useful questions, not in any way special. But I did the prompt again and just uploaded the book as an attachment and then said, can you give me 10 substantive questions? So I will just read those out and then give my answer. So the first question is foundation and inspiration. What initially inspired you to explore the concept of the synthetic society, and how did your journey begin in this writing process? Well, it actually begun 2 or 3 years ago. I was asked by the Dutch government to write with a couple of colleagues a report on deepfakes and its impact on society. Think about fake news in the media. Think about false evidence in courtrooms. Also think about pornography. So a lot of fake deepfake videos are actually non-consensual porn. So you make a porn of a woman, which she, of course, never appeared in, but can be highly realistic. So we thought about that. And already I was kind of intrigued both by the quality of the material and also the potential impact on society. And then I went to Japan on a couple of weeks vacation, and I saw a lot of AI applications already used there. For example, a hotel where they didn't have humans working there, but just robot staff, basically. So I started using ChatGPT and saw the advances in there. Like, if you see the model we're using now, how much it improved over the model 3 years ago, it's quite amazing to see. Like, there's still a lot to be done on and worked on, but still the progress is quite interesting. And so I also looked into some papers and helped a colleague with augmented reality and virtual reality. And all that together, like generative AI, it can create content And it makes for a society where it will be increasingly difficult to kind of pinpoint what is real and what is not, what is authentic and what is not. And some experts, it's difficult to estimate precisely, but some experts say in 4 or 5 years, more than 90% of all online content, so videos, audio, text, will be either AI generated or manipulated. So manipulated means there is an original video of, I don't know, Donald Trump, but you manipulate it so as he appears to be denying the Holocaust or something. So if that is true, like 90% or more being fabricated or manipulated by AI, then the question is, what is truth actually, and how do we communicate? Like, if you don't know that the person you're communicating with online or video calling is actually the person, how do you verify what news is, what evidence is? All these kind of questions are triggered by these advances. So this is why I wanted to write a book about it. Second question. Can you elaborate on the selection of those four core technologies? Human robots, humanoid robots, deepfakes, augmented reality, and virtual reality. So in my book, I use those four as a kind of four different aspects of how reality might be influenced. So with humanoid robots, the goal is to resemble humans, basically, to have a robot that is indistinguishable from a human being. And right now, the most advanced application is probably ChatGPT or the large language models out there. And also a lot of engineers are working on what's called soft robotics, really making physical robots that look, walk, and talk like us. And combined, maybe in 50 years, maybe in 100 years, the ideal is to have robots really indistinguishable from humans. And there are a lot of applications for that already. So I already talked about the hotel using humanoid robots as staff. You have them working already in airports. So for example, they are super strong, of course, so can help with carrying luggage. They can sort through documents. But also the advantage is that they could speak basically any language in the world. They're used in medical settings, so human robot surgery or robots being used for patient treatment or to combat loneliness in elderly people. You have robots used by military and also robonauts. So NASA and also the Russians are using robots to, and sometimes also those that look like humans, to explore space, basically. You have robots raising children as a kind of robotic au pair. And you have sex robots, love robots. Then the second thing is deepfakes. And basically, the goal is the same, to be indistinguishable from authentic material, real material, only on a representational level. So they're not placed in physical reality, but are usually a video or sometimes an audio file. And you could have either a virtual person that looks like a human, but isn't, it's just created by AI in a video or in a photo or in an audio fragment, or have a real person do or say stuff they never did or say. Again, several applications already, like I already talked about deepfake porn, but there's also satire, of course. You can think of like digital fitting rooms, so you can shop for clothes, but then see how a new jacket would look like on your own body. You have video calling, for example, with Chinese colleagues, where you can have the video, not only the video call translate automatically as if the Chinese person is speaking English or Dutch or what have you, and you are speaking Chinese, but also that the lip movement is automatically synchronized so that it really looks like you're speaking Chinese. The third is augmented reality, and this is usually also mixed reality. So it takes as the basis real reality, physical reality, however you want to call it, and puts an overlay of AI-generated information on that, usually through the most used is actually mobile phone applications, but you have goggles as well, for example. So you have Pokemon Go, for example, is a gaming application. You have police officers wear glasses with equipped with emotion recognition or facial recognition or WikiTooth, so you can have information posting next to a person or a building. So you can access that right away. You can have tour guides guiding you around on your smartphone. And you have a lot of applications actually in factories as well in industry. So, for example, for precise manufacturing, you have augmented reality applications that kind of help you stay on course or warrant you if you've got a screw somewhere. It was actually popularized first by Boeing. I'm not sure whether that's a good example right now. And also the other way around, it's less popular, but you could also have augmented reality unsee certain stuff. So unsee, for example, the wall between Israel and Palestine. And then finally, virtual reality. This is where you kind of replace real reality for virtual reality, physical reality for AI-generated reality, usually by wearing goggles or a headset of some kind. It's pretty video-oriented, sometimes sound audio is also included. With all these applications, that holds true, and it's not very developed for smell, for example, or scent. And so for virtual reality, there's again medical applications. Think of pain relief, or people are treated for body disorders, image disorders, where you can see yourself as an avatar, either real or altered, to change your perception of self. You can have it for virtual traveling, so you can go to the North Pole or Antarctica without harming the nature there. Stuff like this, sex, tailored dildonics, I also learned quite a lot when writing the book, is a popular application, is where you can have sex with your own partner or someone else using virtual reality and other stuff to make for a real sex experience. Question 3. Educational implications. What role do synthetic technologies play in the transformation of the educational systems, and how should we prepare for these changes? Well, there's quite a number of applications actually in terms of educational settings. So think of VR being used in medical schools, in medical settings, where students are required to see an organ or a patient with a certain deficiency or problem, but it's difficult for everyone to see it. So VR could bring you closer to the operation of a doctor, actually witnessing it close by. Augmented reality is used, for example, to popularize reading among children, again, by bringing back to life or bringing to life characters in the book. So you could have Pinocchio or whoever pop up out of the book and speak to the child or ask a question, something like that. Deepfakes are being used to have Napoleon give a history lesson to school children and even engage with them, ask them questions or answer their questions about strategic moves or whether the recent film about him is really correct or authentic or not. And at the university right now, one of the biggest fears or discussion points is about the use of LLMs, ChatGPT, for making homework or essays or stuff like that. So you could just, as a student, basically ask ChatGPT, write me an essay on a certain topic, and then use that as a basis to write your essay, which is a little bit dangerous because LLMs are not always correct. They can make errors and mistakes and sometimes even fabulate. So they come up with new, for example, in legal realm, legal cases that never actually happened. But still, it's so valuable that a lot of students already use it, both in terms of language, but also in terms of the sources they do find and the basic structure of the argumentation. It's actually quite good. So some universities are trying to ban LLMs. I think eventually this will be very difficult. I think it will be so widely used that it's impossible to really counter that. Also because in terms of proof, it's really difficult to prove that a student X has really used LLM, not only to correct the language, but also to help out in writing or something like that. So I think eventually we need to think of like ways to integrate it into education rather than trying to ban it altogether. And it might actually benefit in a lot of ways if you could ask large language models to already give a structured argumentation or something, or correct your own argumentation, or be play the devil's advocate and say, like, this is my line of reasoning, but could you give me 5 counter arguments against my thesis? That would actually be very helpful. And I would find it a little bit sad, because this is what I used to do in the bar with my fellow students. We would just discuss our own work or our own ideas, and that would be a very lively discussion. And in my mind, that is nicer than sitting at your computer asking ChatGPT the same question. But probably that's me just being conservative and old. Question 4, with the rise of synthetic technologies, how do you foresee the future of work and employment, in particular the balance between human labor and automation? Right, so this is a very difficult question, because right now they're kind of fears for mass unemployment, and indeed there are quite a number of organizations firing people already, like not only in standard jobs and manufacturing jobs, but also finances and also even creative sectors. Like in Hollywood, a big fear of the script writers was actually that AI would be able to generate new scripts for movies or for sitcoms or what have you. I think for certain many jobs we have now would be replaced by AI, but until now it has always happened that humans will find more jobs. And if you see in the history over the past few centuries, people have worked more and more rather than less and less, even though there's more technology and machines around. So I wouldn't put my money on mass unemployment, but there are serious people who say, for example, we need to think about a universal basic income in light of artificial intelligence. Question 5 is societal impact. How do you envision these synthetic technologies altering our societal norms, especially in terms of human interaction and the perception of reality? So this is for me perhaps the most important part of the book, is chapter 4, and it can be downloaded for free. There will be a link in the show notes. It's open access, so feel free to download it and send the link to whomever you think it's important to. So if something like this, like the 90% or more of the online content being AI manipulated or generated, will actually materialize, then this will have a huge impact on our sense of truth, on our sense of reality, and we already live in what some people call a post-truth era. What do you actually trust and what not? You can also create your own news cycle, or you can have more polarization because people will select the news sources they think are real, which may not be exactly the same as what is actually real or true. So this is one potential effect. The other potential effect is that it will become very difficult for media to actually verify whether online content or user-generated content is authentic or not. The same applies to courts. There are already court cases that were facing parties had submitted fake evidence. So you will see that more and more, and it will happen sometimes that a judge will find someone guilty on the basis of fake evidence. It's just waiting for that because it's impossible right now to filter out all inauthentic material. So that's a big impact, I think. And the more overarching question always with these technologies is who actually owns them. And right now it's again the famous Silicon Valley companies that take the lead in this. If they have a big imprint on what we perceive to be real and our sense of reality, that is actually in the hands of private sector companies from America with monetary goal. They want to make profit, revenue. So the question is, do you actually want that? And these are bigger societal questions. I cannot answer those because it also depends on your personal preferences or your political opinions. But it's certainly something I think we should think about. Question 7, about personal data and privacy. Given the extensive use of personal data by synthetic technologies, how do you propose we balance innovation with the right to privacy and data protection? Well, right to privacy, data protection are fundamental rights. You can't balance them against anything. They leave room, so the General Data Protection Regulation or the European Convention on Human Rights, they're not absolute rights, so they leave room for processing personal data under specific conditions, and those conditions have to be met for those technologies to be legitimate. And there are some real concerns for that, like in terms of legitimacy. One very basic example is transparency. So in the GDPR, it says if you're processing personal data about someone, then you should inform that person and kind of tell everything about the data processing and also allow them to object. If you use your augmented reality glasses, for example, in the public, you will gather data on basically everyone. That's the standard setting. And, well, there's no way you could tell everyone that you're processing personal data and what for and how you're going to treat the personal data, etc. So these types of applications are very difficult to bring in line with the GDPR. A more overarching question is all these large language models, AI models, are basically trained on internet data, scraped from the internet. This is not allowed under the GDPR. So actually, if you want to have a strict reading of the GDPR, all these AI applications that are out there right now are simply unlawful and cannot be used in the EU. I doubt whether the regulator will or the court will be so strict in reading the GDPR. But I think if you want to be fair, that's the actual answer you have to give. And then there are many more questions which I deal with in the book, also concerning other human rights, but also with regard to privacy and data protection. Question 8, legal challenges. What are the most significant legal challenges you identify in the book concerning the integration of synthetic technologies into everyday life? Well, this question is a little bit off. I don't give answers to how we should integrate these technologies into everyday life. I do discuss many different legal regimes, so privacy, data protection, freedom of expression, liability law, procedural law, enforcement, you name it, consumer law, the AI Act, of course. But the main goal is actually to show the many questions AI technologies will raise, and it's not evident what answer should be given or will be given by courts. I cannot give all examples, but there are examples, for example, over liability. Like there are many, many parties involved in the general or the typical synthetic technology. There's a party gathering the data, training AI. There's a party labeling the data. There's others correcting the algorithm or curating it. Then it's given to another company and they design a product. It's marketed by another company in, for example, the EU. Then the user uses it, for example, given certain queries or prompts that make an AI system respond in a certain way. And in this value chain, there's usually like 5, 6, or 10 parties involved. It's quite unclear who will bear the responsibility for if something goes wrong. It's not clear who you can go to, for example, to court. Also, because many of those parties are not based in the EU, and the parties that are usually the user, and they usually don't have the biggest influence over the AI system and also don't have money. So if you're looking for that, it's also difficult. So this is something the law could improve on. Another question, for example, is with intellectual property, like who owns the intellectual property over a song you create or an essay you write via ChatGPT or another large language model. Certainly not the algorithm yet, AI yet, but maybe we arrive at a point sometime that it's so creative that actually we are faced with the question, like, should AI itself be seen as a legal person? There are already some people who think like robots should have rights themselves. But that's still a bit far removed. But the question is it the user? For example, I will say, write me a song about Mark Rutte in the style of Taylor Swift, for example. So the AI learns about data from Taylor Swift, about Mark Rutte on the internet. It is working on and within the boundaries set by the company, and I am giving it the prompt or the query. So where should we give the intellectual property right to? Can, for example, Taylor Swift object to a song being made in her style or tone of voice? These type of questions, also with competition law, consumer law, etc., it's hugely complex. And with freedom of expression, to give an example, there are so many content now being produced that is not per se directly harmful. So you can't object to it under current law, mostly because there's no direct personal interest or societal interest at stake. But they are untrue, or they are at least not authentic. And so they do contribute to a post-truth society. So taken together, they might have a huge impact on society. Should we perhaps ban or prohibit or fine statements that are untrue or not authentic? And if so, how? And probably not, because that's a bit totalitarian, but it is a type of question that comes up. Question 9. Regulatory solutions. In your book, you discuss regulatory alternatives for addressing the gaps presented by synthetic technologies. Can you share one or two solutions you find most promising or challenging? Well, one solution people are working on right now is on waterproofing, watermarking all content, basically. And so, for example, in a courtroom or with media, but also in personal communication, you would only trust a video, a photo, an audio file that has a watermark. And a watermark basically shows this, it's a logbook. This photo was taken there and there by that and that person via this and this camera. Then it was altered by brightening the light or what have you, by that and that person on that computer, etc., etc., etc. So you can see who did what and potentially assess whether it's relevant, because I think the presumption should, if this prediction becomes true, right now we as lay people, but also media and judges, we kind of presume something to be authentic unless there are contraindications. And if this prediction becomes true, then we should do it the other way around. The presumption should be, presumably, it's generated by AI or manipulated by AI. And if so, who did that? Why did a person do that? How did he do that? Is it relevant for this court case or for this media report? And there, watermarking might actually help. The second thing I would point out is the question whether the government should perhaps do more itself in terms of developing AI products. It's right now almost exclusively left to the market. And given its big impact, and given the fact that it's used in medical settings, in educational settings, what have you, in law enforcement settings, should we leave that all to the market, or should perhaps the government or the EU step in and develop public alternatives, which have embedded in them respect for human rights and ethical values? To give an example, how difficult is it to just have a public alternative to X or Twitter? It's not rocket science to have an X-type platform. So why shouldn't the government generate something itself? And certainly for AI and its big potential impact, you have right now a huge reliance of not only citizens, but also governmental organizations themselves on the private sector, usually American firms, offering these services and products. And there's an increasing gap in terms of knowledge, in terms of data, about citizens, about how these technologies work. And this is only going to get bigger. So perhaps we should think about the government or the EU either developing these products themselves or incentivizing the development of these products by non-for-profit organizations or by setting out funds for developing these technologies under certain conditions with respect for human rights. Another example I could think of is applying the precautionary principle to AI. So right now we have the precautionary principle in environmental law, but we also know it a bit in medicine. So there the presumption is that you have to prove that a drug or a medicine is safe and doesn't do harm before you put it on the market, not just test it out and then see what happens. And usually with technology, we do it the other way around. We just allow it to be put on the market, then see whether it does harm. And if it does harm, well, usually it's already too late, but maybe we will try to restrict it a bit. And given the big potential impact of AI, you could think about introducing something like the precautionary principle in AI legislation as well. And then for the final question, which is question 10, global regulatory frameworks. Considering the global impact of synthetic technologies, what are your thoughts on establishing a cohesive international regulatory framework to manage these advances? Well, I don't think, to be honest, that will happen because there are such stark differences in how China, the US, the EU, and all the other partners in the world would want to regulate synthetic technologies. So perhaps you could have a general document stating kind of the basic ethical principles, with which it's difficult to disagree. So AI should be responsible and transparent and what have you. But I don't see that really as having teeth, really. So for now, actually, I think the EU in particular, and also in part the Council of Europe, are becoming a bit of the world leaders in regulation. And you already had with the GDPR what is called the Brussels effect. And that is the effect that because all companies that want to do business in the EU have to accord to the GDPR standards, so Google and Facebook and what have you, and if data about EU citizens are transferred to non-EU countries, those countries or those companies have to accord to the GDPR. This means that so many organizations and countries are affected by the GDPR that it has the tendency of becoming kind of the global standard in data protection. And this potentially the EU and the Council of Europe could also try to achieve for AI regulation. And then presumably AI would still be developed mainly in the US and China and Korea and Japan. But the EU at least would have some regulation on it. And hopefully that would also have an effect for the better. So this was the, these were the 10 questions ChatGPT asked me. Feel free to buy the book. It's not too expensive. I think it's like 25 euros or something like that. But again, it's also available open access. Just download it, click on the link, read it, spread it, post it on wherever you think it's relevant. And if you have questions for me or remarks or think like I missed a spot, we are already thinking about the second edition, because as you can imagine, both like the technology and the law in this respect is developing very rapidly. So I would appreciate any feedback basically on what I got wrong or what you liked in particular or what you think I should talk more about or less. Just mail me on my university email address and hope to hear from you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You can follow for more updates from the Digital Legal Lab by visiting the links in the description. Stay tuned for the next episode of Research Conversations.